the same. When I'm too concerned by what they say, why should I wanna have you? To doubt you would be the worst mistake. Deep inside I know that amidst all the darkness and everything which makes no sense, I know that you exist. Guides me through my darkest nights, shows me right from wrong in a world that often lies. Cause I don't need anyone, anything in life but you. No, I don't need anyone to show me my way. No, I don't need anyone but you.
Hello everyone and welcome back to another episode of The Subcontinent.
The Subcontinent.
Hello everyone and welcome to another episode of The Subcontinent, a weekly programme that will address the most important issues in the South Asian region that affect the governments, organisations, communities and most importantly, the people. And as always, we will dissect the issues and present you with different perspectives from experts and people. So, stay tuned.
In this edition of The Subcontinent, we will discuss British Prime Minister Boris Johnson's maiden visit to India as part of efforts to draw the country closer to the West and away from Russia. And we shall also take a look at the deteriorating security situation in Afghanistan in the wake of the resurgence of the Daesh terrorist group with overt and covert backing of Western spy agencies.
British Prime Minister Boris Johnson's long-delayed visit to India in March was overshadowed by his controversial visit to a JCB factory in Gujarat, but the main agenda of his maiden visit was clear: to woo New Delhi with an attractive defence partnership and wean the country off its reliance on Russian arms as the war in Ukraine rages on. While the offer of defence collaboration was not entirely snubbed, New Delhi made it amply clear that it was very unlikely to abandon its long-lasting ties with Russia.
British Premier Boris Johnson dashed off to India in the third week of April to entice the Narendra Modi-led government in New Delhi with a bag full of offers. The timing of the visit was interesting. In the middle of the war in Ukraine and with the UK and other Western powers mounting pressure on Russia to end its military operation in the former Soviet Republic. For Johnson, the task was cut out. It was to persuade New Delhi to recalibrate its position on the raging war in Ukraine in lieu of defense exports and expertise in building its own military equipment. Johnson told Modi that the UK would streamline licensing rules to export defense equipment to India. That's the first time this facility has been extended to a country outside the European Union and the US. He also offered to transfer advanced technology to produce fighter jets in India and support India's maritime technology needs. While India welcomed closer defence collaboration with its former coloniser, it unequivocally conveyed to the visiting official that New Delhi's bond with Moscow was unbreakable. Plus, military analysts are of the opinion that the move designed to draw India closer to the West is bound to fail, as Moscow remains a one-stop shop for India's military needs due to unrestricted tech transfers, price and suitability.
Johnson's first visit to India came amid raging war in Ukraine, where New Delhi is seen batting on Moscow's side. As a country overwhelmingly dependent on Russian arms, India has refused to join Western countries, including the UK, in condemning Russia's military operation in Ukraine. To coax India to change its stance, many top Western officials have made whirlwind trips to New Delhi in recent weeks, but almost all of them have returned red-faced, Johnson being the latest.
As a country overwhelmingly dependent on Russian arms, India has understandably refused to join hands with Western countries, including its Quad partners, in condemning Russia's military operation in Ukraine. Top Indian officials have maintained that the country's position on the Ukraine war is driven by national and strategic interests. Even Johnson acknowledged it after he met with Prime Minister Modi in New Delhi, saying he agrees with India's position on Ukraine, as the South Asian country shares a historic relationship with Russia that everybody understands and respects. The remark suggested that the British Premier reluctantly swallowed a bitter pill. India has shared time-tested defense ties with Russia and relies on it for nearly half of its imported military equipment, despite tensions with Russia's close regional ally, China, and in the face of pressure from Western countries that have scores to settle with Moscow. While the government in New Delhi has called for an end to the war in Ukraine, it has been unwilling to take a hard-nosed position against its Cold War ally. Johnson had hoped to change that equation with his security offers, as well as a free trade deal, but experts stress that dislodging Russia as the top defense partner remains an uphill task.
Now, to have more insight, we have invited Mrs. Naeemah Mahjoor, columnist at Independent Urdu, to the program. Now, Mrs. Mahjoor, let's begin with the British Prime Minister's recent visit to India. Boris Johnson said his country would expedite defense exports to India and also provide expertise in building India's own fighter jets. Now, how significant do you think this is?
Well, this visit of Boris Johnson was long overdue, but, you know, due to COVID pandemic, this visit was delayed. And I think it has a lot of significance at the moment, keeping in view the changing world scenario when there's a huge debate going on between East and the West, the waning power of U.S., the Russian-Ukraine war, and the sides taken by those countries which West particularly wants to take a clear stand, and India is one of them. I think the West is again asking neutral countries to take open stand against Russia, like, you know, it imposed its policy of either be with us or against us on Taliban after 9/11 attacks. In the past weeks, we have seen many visits of top American officials to India. Boris Johnson's visit can also be counted as an extension of U.S. diplomacy and make India to support it in return for many trade and military deals. The joint statement you might have seen, which was issued after Boris Johnson's visit, explains it all and also gives indication that Western countries can go much beyond the earlier restrictions on sharing defense technology with India.
Mr. Mahjoor, so Johnson's visit to New Delhi came amidst raging war in Ukraine and India's refusal to align with Western powers against Russia. So why is the West so hell-bent on persuading India to recalibrate its position on Ukraine?
Well, despite internal issues of human rights violations against minorities in India, the Western democracies still count India as the largest democracy in the world. India is also considered the only country in Asia to counter China's growing influence and economic landscape in the world. The stand taken by India would matter for Russia, which has a 1 billion market at its disposal. And then the image of NATO countries has become dented since few decades. The debacle in Afghanistan has humiliated it, and then Russia's coming closer to Taliban. India is considered one of the biggest and emerging markets in the world, which capitalists wouldn't afford to leave it unexploited. And the most important thing, Russia's defense industry has India as the biggest buyer in the world. As long as both India and Russia keep this commitment of buying and sharing defense deals, Moscow might not get a hit as the U.S. Wants it to get hit after this Ukraine war if India keeps supporting Russia. Amid this whole scenario, I think the UK PM's visit has this intent of persuading India to break this commitment with Russia so as to become a partner in New World Order and get too much in return for it.
Mr. Maju, we know that India and Russia share long-standing defense ties, and New Delhi continues to rely on Moscow for nearly half of its imported military equipment. Now, is it safe to argue that India won't go against its national and strategic interests to please Western allies?
Not only defense deals or military hardware or knowledge-sharing agreements are India's national or strategic policies, but Moscow has always proved a rock-solid support for India, be it veto in UN on Kashmir or stand against Pakistan. The only issue which has become a point of concern among Indian defense circles at the moment while watching Ukraine war is, can Russian military hardware meet Indian demands, or can it sustain attacks from its enemies like China or Pakistan in future? The Ukraine war has proved Russian war machinery not up to the mark or matching to NATO countries. So I think India may not leave Russia, but will certainly upgrade its defense equipment with the defense deals with the UK and other NATO countries. And the UK has already promised India to share its latest technology, and we have to wait for it.
On that note, I would like to thank Mrs. Mahju from London for being on the program. Now, let's see how people have reacted on social media.
David Lammy, a Labour Party MP, says Prime Minister Boris Johnson is scared of briefing the British Parliament on his fruitless trip to India, which shows the trip was meant to distract attention from scandals at home. Independent journalist and commentator Sunny Hundal blasts Boris Johnson for visiting India in the middle of the Ukraine war, noting that India is far more pro-Russia than many in the West actually realise. Bruce McDee, a political blogger and activist, says Johnson's justification of visiting India in a failed attempt to change the lies agenda at home was to shift India's position on Ukraine, in which he failed completely.
You're listening to The Subcontinent, broadcast by IRIB English Radio. This weekly program reviews ongoing developments in India, Pakistan, and Bangladesh. Listen to The Subcontinent every Monday here on IRIB English Radio.
A spate of deadly terror attacks has rocked Afghanistan in recent weeks, sending ripples of fear and panic across the country and challenging the rulers in Kabul barely 8 months after the botched exit of US-led allied forces. What's remarkable is the consistent pattern of these attacks, the same set of perpetrators and victims. Most of these attacks have been claimed by the Daesh terrorist group, which has managed to regain a foothold in the crisis-stricken country with the overt and covert support of foreign spy agencies.
The holy month of Ramadan was again marked by violence and bloodshed in Afghanistan, where the Daesh terrorist group has made a comeback in parallel with the Taliban's dramatic takeover. A string of explosions ripped through schools, mosques, buses and markets in major cities such as Kabul, Mazar-Sharif and Kunduz in recent weeks, leaving scores dead. Most of these attacks targeted members of the minority Hazara Shia community, which has a history of persecution. Daesh proudly claimed responsibility for the carnage, further destabilizing the nation that is already grappling with the worst economic and humanitarian crisis. However, what has got security analysts thinking is the ease and ferocity with which the terrorist group has been able to carry out recent strikes, which evidently points to the hand of Western spy agencies that have shared goals with Daesh now. Notably, in the months leading to the U.S. ouster from Afghanistan, thousands of terrorists made their way into the country and were recruited by Daesh. What is also notable is these foreign terrorists infiltrated the country under the nose of U.S.-led allied forces. There is a popular belief that Daesh and Western spy agencies are hand in glove in destabilizing the country to undermine the Taliban rule and manufacture a pretext to invade the country again.
The latest spell of violence in the crisis-hit South Asian country and the resurgence of the Daesh terrorist group has created fresh security challenges for the Taliban rulers, who continue to insist that the group has been wiped away from the country. While it's becoming increasingly clear that the terrorist group is playing the role of proxy for Americans in Afghanistan, pressure is mounting on the new rulers in Kabul to put an end to violence and ensure the safety and security of vulnerable ethnic minorities.
The country lying at the crossroads of South and Central Asia is again finding itself in the grip of foreign-backed terrorism after 20 years of foreign military occupation. Having been humiliated and thrown out of the war-ravaged country, foreign powers have now found a new ally in Daesh to execute their nefarious designs in the country. Iran's President Ebrahim Raisi recently pointed to this fact by holding Western spy services responsible for violence in Afghanistan. President Raisi also called on the Taliban to get its act together and protect the lives of all Afghans, including religious minorities. There seems to be a consensus on the fact that the buck stops at the current rulers in Kabul. The responsibility of protecting the citizens of Afghanistan and eliminating all forms of terrorism lies with the Taliban. While Daesh sees the Taliban as an irreconcilable enemy that needs to be militarily defeated, the Taliban sees Daesh as an evil force that has no place in Afghanistan. It is incumbent on the Taliban to eliminate the new threat posed by Daesh and its foreign backers, and it's also important for the group to form an inclusive government, which can pave the way for peace and stability in the country.
Now, to shed more light, we are joined by Mr. Mustafa Ariyai, author at Covert Action magazine. So glad to have you again on the program, sir. Now, Afghanistan has been rocked by a string of deadly explosions in recent weeks, mostly targeting minority Hazara Shias. What do perpetrators seek from attacking schools and mosques in the holy month of Ramadan?
Right. Unfortunately, we have been witnessing a cascade of terrorist attacks for the last couple of weeks in Afghanistan. And this is part and parcel of another greater project whereby, certain forces are trying to stoke more violence in the country and thereby creating more instability in Afghanistan. And it is, of course, very suspicious that this, the timing of it, of course, one would expect that during the holy month of Ramadan, an attack like that, an inhumane attack like that, should actually never happen, but certainly not during a holy month like that, whereby unknown number of innocent civilians are being killed. And so one cannot merely call this sectarian violence anymore. There are reasonable voices that who would even plead that everything that is happening in the country or has been happening for the last two decades actually signifies something much greater than sectarian violence, namely genocide. Over and over again, we have seen how the Shiite minority in Afghanistan, but also, as of recently, we have seen attacks orchestrated against Sufi groups in the country, and whereby an attack was orchestrated against a group of Sufis while they were praying or in their place of worship, which was in Dar Lamon, which is located roughly 2 kilometers from the capital, Kabul. And that attack culminated in the death of at least 300 innocent civilians. So, and this kind of violence, unfortunately, goes back 20 years ago when Afghanistan had a Western-backed corrupt government. And in that, you know, under the reign of both Karzai and Ahmadzai, and with their entire entourage of political supporters, which included also many leaders or political leaders from different religious groups and ethnic groups, but they were unfortunately all involved in a situation where they were more preoccupied with their own personal gainings rather than taking care of collective interests, that of the Afghan people.
Mr. Ariari, Daesh claimed responsibility for the terrorist attacks, even though Taliban officials insist that the group has already been wiped out from the country. Now, do you see a sinister game being played by foreign powers to destabilize the country?
Absolutely. I mean, it was pretty much wishful thinking by a lot of people when they saw the Americans or the Western powers leaving Afghanistan. And a lot of people were thinking, oh, this is probably the end. But I would say this is only the beginning of the end. Of course, the foreign powers, they didn't just leave Afghanistan. Of course, there was a power vacuum when they left the country, and the Taliban took it over. And it was some kind of a very, almost an ideal situation where you had the United States, you know, the occupiers leaving the country, and they were indeed occupiers. But it was not that they left the country without a strategy, or they just left the country with, well, okay, we lost the war and that's it. No, they have a long-term strategy for the entire region, which includes Afghanistan, but also the broader region, Central Asia. And it's this brings us back to a historical time span where there was a great power rivalry between terroristic Russia and the great British Empire. And that was coined as a great game. But for many Afghans, this great game has never really stopped. And there are very sinister plans involved, unfortunately, because there are still many CIA officials operating in Afghanistan. And so the West certainly does have a stake in that part of the region. And Afghanistan, unfortunately, happens to be a part of that.
Now, many reports suggest that Daesh Takfiris have regained foothold in the war-ravaged country with the patronage of Western spy agencies to undermine Taliban government and to foment civil war. Now, what's your take on this?
Well, unfortunately, the Taliban government doesn't have that much of a support inside the country. And I think that both Daesh and Taliban, from an ideological point of view, are pretty much related to one another. They're both adhering to a very hardcore branch of Hanafi style government where there is no place for pluralism, and of course the Daesh you know, divide and rule, that is still the prevailing rule by foreign powers, and how to, in terms of how to meddle in a country that is not much of their liking. And Afghanistan is certainly, it is an epicenter of that in Central Asia, where they really try to make Afghanistan once again a safe haven for terrorism. The end goal, of course, would be the destabilization of Afghanistan and with it Central Asia. And that forms an existential threat to a lot of neighboring countries, but also regional powers like Iran, and of course, great powers like China, Russia. So, yes, there are many very, very dark plans involved, unfortunately, and outside powers, they have a great stake in that. And the Taliban is a symptom of that, but, you know, one could easily think of Daesh, because even there were even reports back, you know, years ago where the Afghan Defense Ministry actively took part in replacing Daesh elements from the south of Afghanistan to the north. So it was a long-standing plan already, and it comes into fruition now. And Daesh, unfortunately, they already had a hold in Afghanistan.
There you have it, Mr. Ariyayi, author at Covert Action magazine from the Netherlands. Thank you for being on the program, sir. Now, let's see how people have reacted on social media.
Qom seminary scholar and multimedia producer Sheikh Muzaffar Abbas cites the leader of the Islamic Revolution, Sayyid Ali Khamenei, back in 2018, warning of the U.S. relocating Daesh terrorists from Iraq and Syria to Afghanistan. Hadi Nasrallah, a political analyst and writer, says the recent string of terror attacks in Afghanistan bears the hallmark of the U.S. spy agency, which is using its proxy Daesh to stoke civil war in Central Asia. Filmmaker and writer Richard Woolley states that Al-Qaeda has always been America's proxy force in the region, who together with the Daesh terrorist group carry out the amoral and devious mission of the U.S.
And that was our episode about Western efforts to woo India with attractive defense cooperation offers to push it away from Russia. And also how Daesh and foreign backers are hell-bent on destabilizing Afghanistan and stoking civil war and sectarian divide in the country. We shall meet again next week. So till then, take good care.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
One of the psychologists paid tens of millions of dollars by the U.S. Central Intelligence Agency to oversee the interrogation of prisoners in the so-called War on Terror, provided new details about the torture of a Guantanamo Bay detainee at CIA Black Site in Thailand. Please stay with us for an article in this regard written by Brett Wilkins, journalist. This article is published under the heading, "All of these guys belong in prison. CIA torture described in vivid detail by psychologists. Here's more. One of the psychologists paid tens of millions of dollars by the U.S. Central Intelligence Agency to oversee the interrogation of prisoners in the so-called War on Terror, provided new details about the torture of a Guantanamo Bay detainee at CIA Black Site in Thailand. The New York Times reports James E. Mitchell told a military judge during a pretrial hearing at Guantanamo that Abd al-Rahim al-Nashiri, a Saudi national facing possible execution for allegedly masterminding the deadly 2000 bombing of USS Cole in Yemen, broke quickly under torture and became so obedient that he would crawl into a cramped confinement box before guards ordered him to do so. Initially, guards had to force al-Nashiri into the box, but according to Mitchell, the prisoner liked being in the box and would get in and close it himself. Annie W. Morgan, a former Air Force defense attorney who is a member of al-Nashiri's legal team, told the Times that when she heard Mitchell's testimony, got the image of crate training a dog and became nauseous. That was the goal of the program, to create a sense of learned helplessness and to become completely dependent upon and submissive to his captors, she added, referencing a tactic taught in U.S. torture programs and documents dating back to 1950s. Gail Held, a former CIA analyst who advocates Guantanamo's closure, tweeted, "Imagine the hell Mr. Nashiri experienced outside of that box that made him prefer being inside it." Nashiri's attorneys, who argued that evidence in the case is tainted by torture, questioned Mitchell about what happened at Thailand Black Site in November 2002, when former CIA director Gina Haspel oversaw the secret prison. The psychologist's testimony is meant to shed light on abuse that may have been recorded on scores of videotapes documenting detainee torture that were later destroyed at the behest of then CIA counterterrorism chief Jose Rodriguez, who claimed in his memoir that Haspel drafted the 2005 cable ordering the move. Mitchell, who along with fellow psychologist John Bruce Jessen was paid $81 million by the CIA to develop and supervise an interrogation regimen for terrorism suspects, described how the diminutive al-Nashiri was so scrawny that guards stopped subjecting him to the interrupted drowning torture commonly called waterboarding for fear the prisoner might be seriously hurt. In addition to waterboarding and other approved torture techniques, a declassified 2014 U.S. Senate Intelligence Committee report revealed how interrogators threatened to sexually assault Nashiri's mother and how he was terrorized with a power drill and raped. Mitchell told the court that one interrogator used a belt to strap Nashiri's arms behind his back and lift him up from behind to his tiptoes. Mitchell said he objected after the prisoner howled in pain, fearing his shoulders would be dislocated. The torture continued. Guards forced the shackled prisoner onto his knees, then bent him backward with a broomstick placed behind his knees. In a bid to train al-Nashiri to call him sir, the chief interrogator gave him a cold bath before scraping a stiff bristled brush from his to his face and his mouth. Times previously reported interrogators continually told Mr. Nashiri they did not believe he was telling everything he knew, threatening him with worse treatment if he did not tell them more. The prisoner, already subjected to the whole array of CIA torture techniques, loud noise, sleep deprivation, forced nudity, wall slamming and waterboarding, insisted he was trying to remember and tell them everything. But the interrogators appear to have ultimately concluded that Mr. Nashiri was not lying. Some of the cables back to headquarters, apparently written by Ms. Haspel, described him as compliant and cooperative, according to the 2014 report on the interrogation program by the Senate Intelligence Committee. In addition to the black site in Thailand, Nashiri, who was captured in Dubai in October 2002, was imprisoned at CIA black sites in Afghanistan, Poland, Romania, and possibly Morocco before being sent to Guantanamo in September 2006. In 2010, he was granted victim status by the Polish government, whose cooperation with and complicity in George W. Bush administration's extraordinary rendition and torture program was later revealed and investigated. In March, human rights advocates condemned the U.S. Supreme Court's decision allowing the Biden administration to block Mitchell and Jessen from cooperating with Polish prosecutors investigating the torture of Saudi terror suspect Abu Zubaydah. The Bush administration officials who devised, approved, and implemented the post-9/11 torture regimen have enjoyed total impunity. Not only did Bush's successor, former President Barack Obama, break a campaign promise to investigate and prosecute abuses as required by U.S. and international law, his Justice Department actively shielded them from accountability as torture continued at Guantanamo.
Questions and answers in Islamic upbringing.
I have a son. He's really fond of football, and he's so weak in his lesson courses. I really don't know what should I do.
Could you tell me when we have to start upbringing of our kids, that is, from the very beginning of the birth?
I have a little son, and he's so disrespectful. I want to know how to treat him according to the teachings of the Ahlul Bayt, peace be upon them.
Answering parents' questions in upbringing their children in an Islamic way.
Do you know what Islam is? It's a way of life for all. It is taught in the Quran for big and small.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله وبركاته Dear listeners of IRIB English Radio This is your host Musa Al-Bahadli and you are now listening to the program Islamic Upbringing In this program you will discuss issues, relevant questions and other fields regarding the Islamic upbringing of children and we would like to stress that the answers that we provide in this program are all based upon the narrations of the household of the Prophet and, of course, of the Prophet himself and upon the Holy Quran, supplemented with scientific research. Joining us in the studio today is our dear friend, Sheikh Ali Himani, who is an Islamic researcher at the Seminary of Qum. Dear Sheikh, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh, and thank you for joining us.
Alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah. It's my pleasure to be here in your studio.
Today, dear Sheikh, I would like to talk about the role the hormones they play in this stage, this teenage stage in our youth's lives. And we also would like to talk about or ask you myself, Sheikh, obviously I know the answer, but only at a surface level. Does the way that other people dress and their appearance, does that also affect how our teenagers dress?
Correct. Look, this age that we're talking about, the teenage, or for girls just before teens, you know, her age of puberty, this is a time of hormonal changes, you know. And one of the elements that is impacted by hormonal change is the sexual desires, right?
Right.
A lot of people feel that this is a taboo thing. You don't talk about it. You don't discuss with your children. Don't mention it. Don't talk about it from the member or even from the talk shows like this. They're like, oh, talking about sex. Oh, my God, you know. But this is very important because the lesser you know, the poor you manage your children. The more you know, the clearer you are, the better you manage your children and the better you upbring them.
But just to add a little point about why it is not spoken about in the minbar or in the broad appearance and public, it's because that is the mission and that is the task, duty of the parents.
And they need to be
educated themselves about it.
And the problem is, like, let me relate this back here. The problem is that parents don't come to informational gatherings apart from Muharram and Maha Ramzan.
Right, yeah.
And the only thing that they want to attend is minbar. If there's majlis and there's azadari and there's crying for Imam Hussein, Imam Ali alayhi salam, they come and attend it. Apart from that, if you say, okay, one lecture on child upbringing for your age 0 to
you
7,
see them all
7
gone.
To, no one's there. Only the speaker and his poor coffee there.
I talked to a Islamic researcher, Islamic scholar who specializes in Islamic upbringing of children. And I asked him a question because we always used to talk about how important it is for parents to educate themselves on raising a child.
Correct.
And so I asked him, have you ever been approached by a parent who asks you all of these questions and who has all of these problems?
Correct.
Who have themselves read a book about Islamic upbringing?
Uh-huh.
And he says, no, never.
Never.
Because
no one wants to read, you know?
No, they do not want to. They think, and I've seen this mentality, that they think, yeah, as soon as you get a child, as soon as the mother, she births her child, she becomes a mother. She knows everything. And it's the same for the father.
Ilham.
Yeah, it comes, in the
naturally
instance.
Naturally to them. No, but the challenge is, like you've rightly pointed out, the parents don't read the books. They don't even approach scholars asking for advice.
They don't educate themselves at all.
And when do they approach the scholar?
When
it's
too late.
When
they're faced with so many problems.
When the child is indulging into so many more problems. And that's when they say, oh, please help me. And you're like, you've come too late. They're like, oh, that's an excuse. You don't have an answer. You don't have a solution.
They think there's one dua or one pill you can give them and feed it to your child and that's it.
Fortunately,
that's not how it is.
You have handed over your child to the television for 7, 8, 9 years, constantly feeding him information.
Unsupervised.
And then you want the scholar to talk to him for 20 minutes, 30 minutes, 1 hour,
and change
his whole life and worldview and perspective.
Right.
Not going to happen, right?
Right. Let's go ahead and take a quick break, dear Sheikh.
This is Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
Contact us at englishradio@irib.ir.
Welcome back, dear listeners. You are now listening to the program Islamic Upbringing. Now, just before we went on a break, we were talking about the impossible task that some parents, they give to these scholars who, they come to these scholars after their children have already, for example, been in a car accident.
Great.
And they tell them, okay, how can we cure them? How can
I
prevent this accident?
Yeah, how can I prevent this accident?
It has already happened.
It's over. It's over. Right. It's already there. So I think, you know, as a suggestion probably to our viewers and listeners, as a suggestion that, you know, maybe you should talk to your community centers and ask them to organize programs which talk about child upbringing at different age levels, including this topic, the taboo topic of sexual desires of our teenagers.
Right. Of course, you should do this in a controlled environment.
Obviously.
Don't have mixed gender groups.
Correct.
Right, for example.
Correct. Doing it separately.
Do it logically, Islamically.
And making sure that the right kind of audience is attending it, so on and so forth. So taking care of all those. But we need to understand that hormonal changes, and sexual desires is a natural process of growing up of a teenager, be it a girl or a boy. They go through it naturally. And if someone is not having these desires, that means there's a problem with it. There's a medical problem with it. They need treatment for that.
Right.
So it's a natural process. But there are certain elements that impact it by intensifying it or absolutely weakening it. One of the elements that contributes towards intensification of sexual desires is the kind of dressing that people wear around.
Oh, that's pretty there. Obvious.
Yeah. So this is where I wanted to point that, you know, when we talk about teens growing up, then the parents, especially mother, and if there's a girl in home who's elder to the boy or younger to the boy, make sure that their dressing is appropriate. You know, we still find people living in the Western world, and because it's a natural norm to wear short skirts or, you know,
short skirt with a jean beneath.
Jean or right. top, or, you know, short tops or spaghetti tops.
In essence, un-Islamic.
Exactly, non-Islamic clothing, right?
Right.
And this is what is going to contribute to his thinking. It's going to give him images, inappropriate images, because he's going through that change. And sometimes it's not in his control.
Right.
The thought process and the images are
it
not in his control.
It is a natural desire.
It's a natural thing, right? So if the mother is not careful of what kind of dress to wear, how to behave with the father at home, particularly when the son is growing up and he's in teenage, or the daughter is growing up and she's in teenage, the father should not wear shorts at home, should not go around topless, shirtless, and stuff like that. And the parents, the interaction between themselves, the mother and the father, they should avoid all kind of intimate interaction, all sensual discussions, even kissing, much so that to make sure that it does not affect the child's thinking.
Would you also say that sweet-talking others in front, like calling your wife, for example, my love, or all of these honeyed words, is that also something you shouldn't do?
No, I think that will be, again, ifrat, like you mentioned, you know,
right.
going to that extreme that, you know, calling her respectable names is okay.
No, not respectable, like lovable.
Names like my dear, my love, honey.
Yeah.
And this honey is not out of that, you know, the sexual element in it, right?
Just so we can put the limit so some people, they do not go to the extreme.
Right? So expressing love, there's nothing wrong with that. Expressing love, which is seen as respect and love together.
Right. Forgive me for interrupting you, but we'll have to go on a quick break.
Sure, then we'll come back.
Yes, bismillah.
يا مقضي الخيرات يا مقضي الخيرات
The Prophet sallallahu alayhi wa alihi wa sallam said, Raise your children to have three features: love for your Prophet, love for his household, and reciting the Quran.
Welcome back to your listeners of IRIB English Radio. You are now listening to the program Islamic Upbringing. Now, just before we went on a break, we talked about that the mothers and fathers, they should be very careful with how they dress and behave in front of their children who are growing up. And we have many narrations and riwayat talking about this.
Exactly.
Like what a mother should wear, what she shouldn't wear.
Exactly.
Right. And how we even have a narration that's very interesting. So even grown up, small girls, sisters, they shouldn't sleep together in the same bed.
In the same bed. And that'll be something we'll be discussing as next part in our, probably the next episode. But today let's focus on the dressing element, right?
Right.
So, and we were talking about expressing love towards your partner. So
right.
the father expressing love towards mother and mother expressing love towards
right.
father.
Be careful, but
exactly.
do not do it too much.
Yeah.
yeah.
You use respectable words. Use
right.
words which are not provocative, especially sensual and sexually provocative words.
Right.
Use words which are respectable and treat her with respect. Show to your children that I'm respecting the mother. They will learn from the father and they will respect the mother. Similarly, the mother should show
right.
that I'm respecting the father. He's the wali of our household. He is the head of the house. He deserves that respect, and she should show that respect. Children will respect the parents.
We have a narration that says, or the meaning of this narration said that the family, the household, the mother, they are the factories of the future generations.
And
everything should be taught in the household, including exactly. how a husband should act with his wife and how a wife should act with her husband.
Exactly.
It is all in the household.
So this is where it all matters. So the dress code of the parents, the dress code of the brothers and sisters around you.
That's also very important.
And
right.
the dress code of the father, all this plays an important role.
Going back to the makeup thing, about when we said that the young teenagers or girls who want to wear makeup, again, do not let them do it too much in
exactly.
front of their brothers.
And now you understand why I
right.
kept saying don't exaggerate,
yes.
don't overdo, because it's going to affect the other siblings in the
right.
house.
Whether
right?
you like it or not, it
but
is a natural
it's
fact.
A natural
and
thing.
Do not
it's
want to mention some of these problems we have
exactly,
in some.
Exactly.
Right.
Now, let me quickly bring you to another part. The dress of the teen himself, you know, the be it girl or boy, avoid, you know, if you are buying it for them or they themselves are buying, tell them not to buy tight dressing for themselves. The more the dress is tighter,
yes,
the more they
is
feel.
Horrible. This
yeah,
is horrible.
I know. The scenario, the situation is really
right.
bad.
Nobody listens to it.
But tight clothing is.
First of all, it's makruh. We have in the riwayat. Do not wear
tight
clothing. Do not
That's
wear
one.
Short clothing.
That's one. Part
right.
two. If we have a boy and a girl in the same house, imagine girl is a teen, boy is also at teen level. Now, boy wants to wear tight clothing, girl wants to wear tight clothing, the body shape is visible. It's
right.
going to contribute to the hormonal imbalance of the boy. And
right.
the boy's dressing is going to contribute towards the hormonal imbalance of the girl, right? So it is extremely important to understand why Islam has certain traditions and
right.
certain ahadith in place which says, don't do this, don't do this,
yes,
don't do
because
this.
It's all
do
about
this and
being
this and
preemptive.
This. Exactly.
Preventing what may happen.
You are providing
right.
the ground for guna.
Yes.
Right? So
for
Islam
sin.
Is right... It is already preconceived all these scenarios
right.
and I've already suggested the methods and the techniques for the parents to follow to make sure that it does not lead our children towards guna.
Well, and just a final narration when we will end today's session about this importance of how people should treat the opposite gender. In what gathering, I believe it was Imam Musa Rida alayhi salam. He was sitting in a gathering, and one of the followers, the Shias, they entered the gathering, and with them were the small daughter. She was maybe 5-6 years old. Now,
Correct.
It is very custom, very normal for us. Everybody says hello to the daughter, kisses her, maybe shakes
Correct.
Her hand, hugs her, right?
Correct. Correct.
And so this follower of the Imam, he took his daughter to the Imam so they may greet each other.
Correct.
And the Imam, he only said, Salaamu Alaikum, only greeted her, didn't
Correct.
Touch her,
Correct.
Didn't look at her.
Yeah.
He treated her like a complete woman.
Correct.
And he was shocked, and... Why did the Imam do so? Because she in the future, or because she herself, she's a woman. She's not a girl any longer.
Correct. And now she's close to that age, right?
Right.
She's 5
yeah.
and 6, and 2 years later,
Already.
She's going to attain,
yes.
You know, bulugh, puberty.
Right.
So right from this moment, she needs to be trained to behave
exactly.
that way.
So I strongly advise our dear listeners to please take a look at the narrations we have, the authentic narrations, and how our imams used to live. Even though they lived in a different age, the circumstances were the same. And with that, we will have to end today's program because we are out of time. I thank you for contributing to this discussion and also thank the dear listeners for tuning in. If our dear listeners have any suggestions, feedback, or some comments, please contact us at our email, englishradio@irib.ir. Alternatively, you can also visit our website, parstoday.com. You can also find us on various social media websites, such as on Twitter and Instagram, under the call handle of Call of Islam Radio. Thank you for tuning in.
Do you know what Islam says? It says that life's the greatest test. It says that life's a borrowed space, returned upon rest.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1520 to 1620 UTC on the following frequencies. 25 meters, 11,865 kilohertz for the Indian subcontinent. And FM 91.5 MHz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and Iran Sat or Bat 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.